Good afternoon and welcome to the Fireside Chat on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, broadcast by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society on www.sechistorical.org. My name is Jeffrey Manns. I'm an associate professor of law at the George Washington University Law School, and I'm the moderator for today's program. In 1977, Congress enacted the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which launched an extraordinary experiment in giving the DOJ and SEC the power to police corruption by U.S. companies abroad. Federal prosecutors are now using the FCPA to investigate a wider range of industries paying foreign bribes, expanding charges against individual U.S. business executives with crimes related to the FCPA, and even exploring the possibility of bringing criminal charges against foreign officials who accept bribes. Joining me today to discuss the impact of the FCPA now and in the years to come are two distinguished panelists. Paul Berger is a partner at Debevoise & Plimpton, LLP, specializing in securities litigation, enforcement, and white-collar crime, and he has an expertise in FCPA regulation and experience with anti-bribery laws from his time at the SEC. Judge Stanley Sporkin is the former director of the SEC Division of Enforcement and a former judge for the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. Under his leadership, the SEC's investigation of corporate payment malfeasance in the aftermath of the Watergate scandal provided most of the evidence for Congress to pass the FCPA in 1977. Welcome to everyone who's joined us online. Today's program will add to the material on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, already in the Virtual Museum and Archive at www.sechistorical.org, including the September 2007 Fireside Chat on the Accounting Aspects of the FCPA, Judge Sporkin's Oral Histories interview in 2003, and the June 27, 1975 address by former SEC Chairman Ray Garrett on the lead-up to the FCPA, aptly titled Homily on the Glories of Right Conduct and the Wages of Sin. The SEC Historical Society, through its virtual museum and archive, shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation. The museum and archive are free and accessible worldwide at all times. The Society is independent of and separate from the SEC and receives no government funding. Both the Society and I want to thank Debevoise & Plimpton, LLP, for its generous sponsorship of today's program. I would like to note that it was the Society who selected me to moderate the Fireside Chat, and I am solely responsible for the topics and questions that will be discussed. I'm grateful to the museum visitors who submitted questions prior to today, and I'll be using those questions throughout the program. Let's get started. Our discussion will focus on three segments. The first will be on the genesis and evolution of the FCPA over its first two decades, from 1977 to 1997. The second part will focus on the surge of enforcement and settlement since 1997. And the last part will consider future developments and challenges facing the SEC's enforcement of the FCPA. So our first question for the day will be this. What was the logic behind vesting the SEC and the DOJ with complementary mandates under the FCPA, and how has cooperation between those agencies developed over time?
Well, I wish I could tell you that this was something that came about by an architect coming in and designing this program. It didn't come about that way. I often get foreign governments come into me and they say, you had a lot to do with this law. Tell us, how did you do it? What was the mechanism? And it was very simple that I was watching a television and watching the Watergate hearings, and at night they'd be replayed, and listening to these people coming forth. And there was a segment that very few people knew about, and that was that corporations were making payments to reelect President Nixon, and that's against the law. And I have an accounting background. Because of that accounting background, it occurred to me to ask the question, how does a corporation bill an illegal payment? And I called one of my people in, and I said, go to see Gulf Oil, since they were the ones who were under the gun at that hearing that day. And this wasn't a great investigation. He came back the next day. He said it was very simple. They set up two bogus accounts in the Bahamas, Bahamian X1, Bahamian Y1, put $5 million in each account, brought the money back to to a fellow named Dorsey, who was the chairman of Gulf Oil at the time. He put it in his safe, And that's where the money was used. And then when we dug into it, we found out that what the money was being used for, in addition to making campaign contributions, it was being used for business purposes and a lot of nefarious kinds of activities, which I really can't discuss today, but they were very, very bad kinds of things. And then I was left with the question of what do we do about it? And my thinking was, how does this fit in with the SEC's disclosure program? And we came to the conclusion. I was the director of the division then, and so I said, well, why shouldn't they have to disclose this? This isn't something material to the a shareholder to know that their company is getting business by paying bribes. At least they should know how much of that business and what would happen if they didn't get the business. And we went with that theory to the commission, and the commission, after thinking and thinking about it, bought it. And we went from there, and this thing just mushroomed because we found a lot of other people doing it. That caught Senator Proxmire's attention, and he called me up and said, well, Stan, don't you need a law? You're enforcing a law that's not on the books. And so we said, yeah, and came up.
First option in the past.
Yeah, and I came up with the idea that I couldn't see how they could. I wanted to enlist the aid of the accounting firms, because if they would see a payment like this, they would immediately stop it. And so the concept was to get a books and records provision. You got to keep back. There was no provision. It says a public corporation took public money, had to keep accurate books and records. They could do anything they want with it. And so that became the cornerstone. We had a great chief accountant there, Sandy Burton, who said, wait a second, we need a requirement that they must keep good internal controls. And that became the second part. Isn't it interesting that at this late date, because Sarbanes-Oxley has a provision about internal control, everybody's complaining, but they were violating the law if they weren't complying with it up to this point, because it's still on the books and is required. And then Proxmire himself said he wanted to have the anti-bribery provisions. And because the anti-bribery provisions came in, that obviously is where the Justice Department, because they had to enforce that. And the second part of the Justice Department was that it was, people said, well, look, it's unfair to load this case against public companies and that private companies would get a free bite. And so a second component was, rather than give that jurisdiction to the SEC, they said we have to give that jurisdiction to the Justice Department. So the Justice Department has not only criminal jurisdiction, but they have civil jurisdiction. So that was the whole scheme. It was nothing really more than that. And it wasn't ever contemplated at that time that in the ordinary kind of course of a foreign corrupt practices, that there'd be overlapping reviews by both the SEC and the Justice Department.
But obviously, over time, there have been many overlapping reviews. And how did that begin to evolve?
Well, it's a violation of the criminal code, and of course, they did it. Now, one of the, again, good points that came out of it, the guy that the Justice Department turned to run that program, Peter Clark, came out of my division. So he understood the law and understood their role and understood our role. And so I think that's the way it worked fairly smoothly over the many years.
And I think there have been tensions over the years between the two in terms of, you know, who's going to take penalty, who's going to take, when the SEC started a program of taking disgorgement with the ABB case for the first time, you know, how would that work? So there have been some tensions, which frankly I think have been healthy tensions, helping both agencies get to the right, you know, answer.
And Paul, one question I have is this. Why does it matter whether the DOJ or the SEC gets credit and what percentage of the pie that they divide up?
Well, I'm not sure people were thinking about it in terms of getting credit, but, you know, agencies have their own kind of proprietary interests. I think it's only human nature that they want to guard their own territory. And there was a very small contingent in the Department of Justice that was looking at FCPA. And early on, back in at least when I was there in the mid to late 90s, a very small number of people also looking at it. And as the interest in enforcing the law increased, and as a policy matter, both agencies decided that this was something worth pursuing and devoting more resources to, both agencies started gearing up, pouring more interest, resources into it, paying more attention to the issue. You know, when the SEC brought the Triton case in 97, that was the first time that the SEC had brought an FCPA case in 11 years. Prior to the 86 Ashland Oil case. So there really hadn't been a lot of attention paid to it. And then in the late 90s, I think both DOJ and SEC, and to some extent the Department of State, started working with the OECD countries to get legislation that would be implemented abroad so that really, when the SEC was prosecuting cases and DOJ, they wouldn't be the only agencies and create something of an uneven playing field, an unintended consequence where you'd have the U.S. prosecuting and putting a U.S. company at a disadvantage to, say, a French company. And so this has evolved over time. It wasn't until roughly 2001 when you had the Convention Against Combating Bribery go into effect and countries start to implement legislation abroad that you had similar laws in place. And up until 2001, there were a couple of countries in Europe that allowed bribery. You could deduct your expenses on your taxes for paying a bribe.
It's quite extraordinary in itself from an American perspective. Let's jump back a little bit in terms of thinking of the history of the FCPA. Judge Sporkin, was it controversial? Was the extraterritorial reach of the FCPA controversial at the time, or were the events surrounding Watergate so unsettling that this really passed very easily?
Well, yeah, but it was much more than that. What developed over the years, this thing just had a life of its own. We found bribery. Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands was taking bribes. Tanaka, who was the head of the Japanese government, indeed, every 5 years or so, I get a visit and a little present from a Japanese reporter that wants to go back and talk about their prime minister.
So do you take that gift?
No, but the point is that these were stunning cases where the whole theory, the whole point is that the fellow that used to head the Federal Trade Commission, and he said to me, he called me over, and he's Charles Reitz was with him at the time. I think he was his one of his top people. And he said to me, Stan, why is it that you at the SEC can get all these laws and we and the Trade Commission, we get killed by Congress? And I said, Mr. Chairman, it's very simple. We don't get a law until we show the need for the law. And we put it in with so much so-called schmutz that people are not going to go, fight and say we're in favor of schmutz.
And schmutz is the legal Latin term.
It's German, yes.
It's Latin.
And so what happened is that for example, when he would want to rein in the undertakers, he had a law. All the undertaker people came to him and said, you can't do that, and they go to the Congress. And it's because he showed nothing that they were doing which would require legislation. It's not needed, And so the whole concept was to get ahead of the game, and that the laws would follow. Once you show the need, the laws would follow. So
and
that really is.
And in your situation, both the Japanese and the Netherlands governments fell as a result of the bribes that were being paid.
That's pretty powerful and persuasive evidence. Though one kind of a caveat, though, would be this, is that it's true that there certainly were some amazing cases of bribery that were exposed during this period. But for the most part, the first 20 years of the FCPA, the U.S. was going it alone. Up until the OECD convention, the U.S. really stood out as being the only major country that had this law in the books and was, to some extent at least, actively enforcing it. And were there pressures that resulted from that?
Well, yeah, because you had the 10 years later, you had the amendment in which they put in some kind of an intent component, even on the books and records. And, yeah, sure, there was a lot of pressure. We're losing business. We're doing this. The same kind of pressure you're getting now on this business of changing the internal excluding small companies from internal controls. I don't know why anybody would want to buy a stock in a company that didn't have good internal controls, but that's really, yeah, of course there's always.
And when I was at the SEC, I was sympathetic to the argument when companies would come in and they'd say, look, you know, sure, we shouldn't be paying bribes, but the fact of the matter is we're up against companies in Europe and elsewhere that are paying bribes, and so we're at a competitive disadvantage, and the more you prosecute, the greater disadvantage we're at. And I think that was the impetus then in the late 90s, early 2000s, to really get out to the OECD countries and get the kind of legislation that was necessary to be in place so that the culture could change and the prosecutors in Europe could start investigating and, where appropriate, prosecuting. And I think, frankly, you're seeing the results of all that work back in the late 90s, early 2000s now. I think you're seeing a lot of countries in Europe that are undertaking investigations. You're seeing, you know, the new head of the Serious Fraud Office in the UK that's taking an active role in these types of matters. You're seeing the German prosecutors conducting dawn raids now. And other prosecutors in Europe are seeing the U.S. model, where prosecutors are looking at these issues and understanding that there may be some benefits in prosecuting and sending messages. So I think, while the playing field is still not an even one, I think it's gaining some leverage so that in the future, in the next 3 to 5 years, you're going to see a much more even playing field.
Paul, you're absolutely right, and I think our government has fallen down, both the Commerce Department and the State Department, in not trying to get some kind of a semblance of a program where these countries that are the so-called the companies where the bribes are taking place would not come forth with a system whereby they would have to, all contracts would have to be vetted and making sure that payments have not been made, and there's got to be a some way of giving a carrot to those companies if they would do it. And I do think, I would hope that the State Department and Commerce would try to develop a program, and it wouldn't be a difficult one, mm-hmm. Whereby that all such contracts would have to be scrutinized by an independent group who would make sure that no bribes took place to get that contract.
Yeah.
And I think if that could be done, it could be very helpful. So you really need two components. You need the enforcement component, but also you need the component, the prudential component, which would say, here's the way that we can cut this, we can
right.
cut this down.
Right. The other thing I worry about, Judge and Jeffrey, is that with the change that's taking place in you know, the increase in legislation abroad and the investigation and prosecution, there is the possibility that, you know, companies that are listed in the U.S. are going to be subject to multiple prosecutions. And we've already seen a little bit of that, and I worry about what that's going to look like in the future. And I think that, you know, if the U.S. regulators are going to occupy that space with respect to foreign private issuers, there needs to be a lot of cooperation and sensitivity to the issues of multiple prosecutions for the same misconduct. And there needs to be some sensitivity to fashioning sanctions that, while meet the goals of deterrence, aren't oppressive.
Yeah, but even just to add on to what you're saying, you're finding foreign companies withdrawing their stock from our market, their registration.
That's right.
And I think part of it's because they don't want to comply with, they don't want to be under our jurisdiction.
Well, and the danger, of course, is if there's not kind of coordination between international authorities, then you'll have a flood of companies potentially exiting listings in the United States.
Yeah.
That is a legitimate concern in terms of the reach of the SEC.
No, I think you're both absolutely right. I mean, there is a legitimate concern. I think the SEC, who is the custodian for, you know, the public companies in this country, have to be concerned not only from the enforcement front, law enforcement program, they have to be concerned about making sure that this is a strong, viable, and robust capital market. And so you want people, you want foreign private issuers here, and you don't want them fleeing because they're considering that the, you know, the prosecutions are oppressive, that there's an extraterritorial reach. There has to be a happy medium. I think the U.S. has to, you know, obviously fulfill its function in prosecuting where appropriate. But I think that the, you know, the countries that are a French company or a Belgian company that's listed here has to understand and appreciate that they have some ability to engage in the kind of business that they've been engaging in, but still in a compliant way. And, you know, my fear is just what you've raised, that these companies will say, this is too much. There's too much cost associated with compliance. And that's why I think, you know, the U.S., particularly the SEC, has to make known what compliance is necessary so that companies understand and can really make a difference with their compliance programs. If they understand what's involved and what the cost is going forward, I think it's easier for them to list and stay here. If they think the cost is going to be huge or in effect oppressive, I can understand the impetus to leave the market.
No, and that certainly is a very significant point. And one related point, though, in terms of cooperation, is there a concern as other countries get more involved in terms of enforcing the equivalent of the FCPA abroad, that you'll have favoritism, such as the United Kingdom protecting BAE when it was in trouble, or other foreign governments going about imposing sanctions, but token sanctions, that effectively are used to insulate those companies from further prosecutions abroad?
You know, the interesting thing is I've never seen that in the U.S. I mean, at least in my experience, Judge, you know, I'd be interested in your perspective, but at least in my experience, the U.S. regulators, when it comes to prosecution, they're interested in prosecuting and pursuing particularly high-profile companies and individuals, so I don't think that's been an issue. It may well be an issue in foreign jurisdictions, and I think that that's something that the U.S., both the Department of Justice and the SEC, and again the Department of State, have to pay attention to in their relationships with their sister regulators.
Very good. One related question is this. Do you think the OECD convention needs to be amended to heighten cooperation and avoid this type of double jeopardy problem? Is that an issue in terms of the actual convention itself, or is it an issue that simply has to be worked out in an ad hoc basis, much as the DOJ-SEC cooperation was worked out on an ad hoc basis?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the OECD can fix it through laws. I think this has to be, regulators have to sit down and understand, because regulators are always going to want to fulfill their function in protecting their markets, and that's reasonable and that's necessary. But they also have to understand the consequences to the company from both a, you know, a business perspective, finance perspective. And so there has to be some appreciation on both sides. I think as there's more regulation and prosecution in Europe, I think there will be more attention paid to this.
Very good. So on a slightly different note, and this is probably a focus on Judge Sporkin, one of the main criticisms of the SEC's enforcement strategy has been its focus on inducing settlements so that we've effectively undercut judicial review of FCPA actions. And is there anything distinctive about FCPA violations that justifies the settlement focus and the minimal judicial accountability?
I you know, that's always been a criticism that's been hurled at the SEC's enforcement program. You can't prevent someone from wanting to settle their problem and to say, well, we don't have a judicial gloss. I mean, why would anybody, if they can resolve it, want to spend, you know, 5 years or so at tremendous costs? And anybody representing a company, as I'm sure Paul and I do, it's always if we can get out of it, we get out of it. I don't think somehow precedent, because a court says it's certain things, that's going to be helpful. I don't see it.
The challenge is this. From an individual client lens, you're completely right. Each individual client wants to settle, wants to move on and put this unfortunate business behind them.
Right.
The challenge, though, is if we have very few precedents dealing with the FCPA, that may end up being something that does end up hurting clients in the future. In the sense there's less guidance as to what it is that one can do and one cannot do. It doesn't have to be judicial in terms of the guidance, but certainly judicial precedents offer one way to go about and give corporations a clearer sense of what their obligations are.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a problem because you're very dependent on the particular moment in time of that law enforcement program. I mean, if the law enforcement program says the law means X and there's no case law out there supporting that, and your client's inclined to settle, then you have to agree that the law means X. And that's not the way that law should develop. Our system is a system where case law develops what the laws Congress passes means. And so I do have a general concern as a policy matter that particularly in an area here which is a very fast-growing area and it's where the prosecutors are very aggressive, the government says this is what the law means, and sometimes even rational, reasonable arguments are not good rebuttals to that. And that's an unfortunate situation.
Well, there is a provision, as you know, to get an opinion from the Department of Justice on certain conduct.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have to exercise that authority more. But, it bothers me that our American system is such that we have to go as close to that line between legality and illegality as possible, and then in order to gain an advantage, we want to have 1 foot over the line.
Sure.
Many of these issues shouldn't even be close. If someone has to start raising these, and I think there's where, regrettably, that the private legal practice has not stepped up, and instead of being there to promote their clients for doing what they want to do, take a more affirmative position to say, hey, look, you can't go there, and let's not. So I don't look at it as a challenge. That, well, how close to the line can we get? Is it going to be good if we pay it on Monday, but if we don't pay it on Tuesday? What happens if we bring a guy over and give him some and treat him nicely? Can we take him to a ball game, or can we take him to a show? I think that if somebody would say, well, what are you doing it for? I mean, why is it that you're doing it? Are you doing it to get business? Are you doing it in order to them seeing what your business is all about? And it seems to me that if you have the right motive and a proper vetting of that with your counsel, I think you can be all right. I don't think anybody is going to try to say, and maybe they would, but again, at least you build up a case. But I think that if it's just a question, well, let's see how close we can get to that line. I cringe when I think, because I think a lot of the problems we've seen recently in this whole subprime area is because people were pushing this thing to the point where it broke. They got much further. People say, well, we don't have to look at it if some rating agency gives us a proper thing. So forget about all this other stuff. No, you can't operate that way.
No, I agree with you. The kind of we shouldn't be kind of moving towards a world where everything's about pushing the envelope and attacking the loopholes. However, that being said, the stakes of FCPA prosecutions have grown exponentially in recent years, which brings us to the topic of the disgorgement of profits, which seems to be one of the biggest themes that's popped up in recent SEC enforcement, and I believe Paul is a bit of an expert on that from his time at the SEC. So I have a couple of questions about that. One, kind of about the logic for why the remedy of disgorgement of profits was introduced and has been used so expansively. And then two kind of follow-ups about that would be, how does the SEC calculate the degree to which violations of the FCPA are the basis for a given company's profits? Because that seems hard to do, and that might seem like it's something where a court might have just as much expertise as the SEC in overseeing.
And fair questions. And it's interesting, just as background, obviously, disgorgement's an equitable remedy and has been available for many, many years. But the SEC in the FCPA context had not brought as a sanction disgorgement until the ABB case, which was roughly in the 2001-2002 time frame. And it occurred to us and the staff at the time that, you know, why not? I mean, if there is one situation where there is clear benefit to the issuer is if you pay a bribe and get a contract that yields a revenue stream of $100 million, why shouldn't you be paying disgorgement for the ill-gotten gains? So, and the commission adopted that as a policy matter. In fact, I think basically they were curious why the staff hadn't pursued that in the past. And so that I think that's become a staple now of FCPA cases. And it, I think it has a very sound logic to it. So I expect we'll see that to continue in the future. In terms of calculation, I think that that's a much, much more difficult subject. The fact of the matter is, in most instances where bribes are paid, there is still consideration for the contract, assuming we're just talking about a contract. There are expenses associated with that contract. A lot of costs are associated with gaining the contract other than just the bribe. And services are rendered, and whether it's a pipeline or it's oil services or it's insurance or in any other area, certain services are provided, and for the most part, they're generally good, reasonable, reliable services. So calculating disgorgement, at least in my view, should not be, well, if you paid the bribe, you should get 100% back on the for disgorgement. I think that that's really a very narrow-minded view of how you approach disgorgement. I think the appropriate methodology is, and ultimately it's going to be one of rough justice, is calculating what is a good, in effect, even though deterrence is generally associated with penalties, what is a good deterrence here for disgorgement? Let's take some of that profit. We can't take all of it because you're actually providing a service and both parties are benefiting. And so at the end of the day, at least I know when I was at the commission, we engaged in what I would describe as rough justice in trying to come up with a reasonable amount that sent the right message and informed the market that disgorgement would be a part of sanctions in the future.
Now, is there a give, and you may not be able to speak to this point, is there a give and take between the corporation and the SEC in terms of figuring out these numbers? Do they present evidence going about substantiating what percentage of the what percentage of their compensation was based on actual work performed?
Sure, sure. I mean, and I think it's fair to say, just generally speaking, that there is a give and take. I mean, you know, I think the SEC may take a very aggressive view at times that, you know, we need 100% disgorgement. And I think the counter view of that is, look, we've got a real product. We have a real sale. We are providing a regular service. There needs to be some acknowledgement of that in determining what is an appropriate disgorgement number.
Fair enough. And then I guess one last follow-up on this point would be kind of the role of judicial review and reviewing kind of the disgorgement of profits. Is that a larger consideration in this context, both because of the dollar values and the inherently speculative nature of disgorgement as a remedy?
Well, so far, there's been no judicial review. And I think, you know, we've seen in a few matters that the SEC has brought where judges, in settled matters, where the judges have actually opened up those settlements for further review. I don't know if that's a trend, but that's certainly something I think that the SEC has to be thinking about in the future when they file a settled case. They're going to have some legitimate basis to argue before the judge if the judge says, I want to look at this settlement, why they've determined that X number is the appropriate number for disgorgement and why the penalty is the appropriate number.
Well, but on that, you do get some inkling if there's a criminal component, because the sentencing guidelines come into play, and you have to look at the tier they're in based upon the amount of money they made. And the other point that's extremely important to realize, what happens when the company is involved in a bribe that goes over many years? They find out about it. They're continuing to do the work. Suppose, for example, the government hasn't found out about it. One of the toughest things that a company has to do is to stop it. And I've had to advise clients of that. You can't continue to accept the benefits of a contract that was obtained through bribery, and that's a tough thing for a very tough thing.
That's particularly tough in M&A transactions where a company is acquiring another company and they discover that the company they've acquired had engaged in inappropriate conduct. And they have to deal with that situation because, as you say, they're still a beneficiary of the bribe.
So we've talked a little bit about the risk of over-deterrence and kind of both in pushing foreign companies out of listing in the United States, but and in terms of the impact it may have on American companies' competitiveness abroad. One question would be the disgorgement of profits would seem to ratchet up significantly the deterrence and the risk of over-deterrence. Is that an argument for, in some way, putting limits or caps on the degree to which we'll have penalties for the FCPA?
Well, the interesting thing about, and actually, Judge, you might want to weigh in here, the interesting thing I've always found about the penalties piece of this is that when Congress passed the legislation, the penalties for bribery, while I guess we could argue they're severe, they're not huge on the civil side. And the penalties for books and records and internal controls can be enormous penalties. And in fact, the way that I think the SEC gets the really big numbers on penalties is through the books and records and internal controls provisions, which allow significant penalties. I don't know how it is that Congress kind of balanced that. One would think, just looking from the outside, that the bribe would be more severe than the books and records violation, but the penalties go the other way.
Well, when that was initiated, there were no penalties.
That's right, and that came in much later.
There was strictly an injunctive action, and if we had thought it like you thought, we would have had the disgorgement. Mm-hmm. And so that's evolved when they put in this in the sanctions provisions in the law.
Yeah,
and I haven't really realize I think you've got a very good point there, and how do you cap it? And I guess through a settlement with the SEC.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, as a practical matter, you're ever going to be in a position to cap these things. I think that these are going to be negotiated settlements. And the SEC will come in with a number. You're going to be back and forth with them on what's the appropriate number. But I think defense counsel have an obligation to push back and say, look, what is the right number here and how are you getting there? I mean, the SEC can be very aggressive because the Act provides that for each violation. Well, what does that mean, each violation? Is that each time it appears in a document, or is it just just one statement? I think, the SEC can get very aggressive, and that's how they get the number so high. And I think defense counsel have to push back. But clearly, the message that the agencies are sending is that this is of such an important area that the penalties are getting ratcheted up. And so that's why you're seeing higher and higher penalties.
This business about the competitive issue that you mentioned, where our companies are being disadvantaged, but now, because there's so many foreign companies that are trading in the United States, you don't have that. That has been eased, that concept of a competitive disadvantage.
So long as they don't delist in light of the FCPA.
Well, and that's going to be a big issue, because remember, you can trade your stock anywhere in the world. You don't need to come to the United States. But I do think that I do think the SEC needs to think about some kind of a proactive type of program, which would give what Paul says some kind of an idea of what a company has to do to avoid getting involved. And I've over the years have been trying to push this so-called immunization program, where a company would know exactly what it has to do and can be immunized if they did it. And so, I think that could be helpful. But again, when we now see with the what has happened with this explosion and the subprime and this catastrophic thing that took place in the past 2 years, which almost brought down world markets, or the Greek government is imploding, the people will want to go to that country which has the best regulation rather than the worst. And I really think that people are going to see now what happens when deregulation is there, and that they and it takes down the markets. So I think there's a rebirth of good, smart regulation, and I think that again would commend our country, our laws to the world. And I think you mentioned that the Brits are now saying they want to have a tougher type of this arbitrage of regulation. It didn't work, or is not working. And look, we were told was not too long ago that we're driving, because the SEC regulates so tough, that we're driving all our business away. And that was in the same year that we had everything that imploded, when Paulson was saying, you at the SEC, you're driving everything away. And I think Cox, to his great credit, stood up and said, no, we're not gonna cut back on our regulation. So
very good. So we focused a bit in terms of disgorgement and the higher dollar amount in sanctions. One other issue, though, is the number of prosecutions and open investigations, which has also exponentially grown. I think at any given moment there are over 100 open FCPA investigations going through the system. Now, does this reflect a dedication of more resources to prosecuting FCPA violations, or a greater commitment to enforcement?
Both. Well, I think both. I agree with you. There are certainly more companies and individuals under investigation. I've heard the Department of Justice say over 130. Interestingly enough, only a very small percentage of those, less than a quarter of a percent, are self-report companies. And I think that, you know, there are a variety of factors that are going on here. You know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when there was a lot of M&A activity, there were more self-reports. There were more companies under investigation, and there were more prosecutions. As the prosecutions continued and the sanctions were ratcheted up, more companies in the market started to take notice and started to pay attention to these issues, and then some more companies would self-report, more companies would do things to remediate their issues. I think that both agencies, DOJ and SEC, decided, frankly, as a matter of policy, to devote more resources to these issues because they noticed that it was a huge problem. They saw that they were having some success with the OECD countries and felt more comfortable prosecuting these cases. And so I know DOJ has beefed up its staff. I know the SEC has you know, they have close to 1,200 people in the Division of Enforcement around the country, and they're spending a lot of resources on this. And as you know, they've just created a unit devoted just to FCPA. So I think that both agencies have made policy decisions that they are going to devote resources to this, and they are going to highlight this as an issue.
The other thing is that everybody's got to realize is the tactics that are being used now are a lot different than what the SEC uses. We're now seeing, you know, tapping of phone calls, sting operations. Those are foreign to the SEC, but you're going to have a lot of that, and therefore
Well, they're still foreign to the SEC. I mean, I don't think the SEC's, they don't have the authority to do that, and I don't think they should be doing that. But I agree with you. You are now seeing tactics that are used by DOJ that you used to see in, you know, organized crime type of investigations, and they're using it in the area of FCPA, and I think that's going to have a dramatic change.
And insider trading.
Insider trading, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, the Justice Department, when they set up this white collar crime unit, is really, you know, is saying, yeah, we gotta do something now. And so I think that, you know, it's, again, another challenge for companies and their lawyers to be able to deal with it. And that's why they got to get proactive and get more counseling, as opposed to more advice as to how to get around things. They got to get more advice how to comply, so you're not going to get caught. Look, we had the Siemens case, and my understanding is that in fees just to that they had to pay when they got when they were investing, I think they're in a $1 billion area. That's a lot of money. Even today, it's a lot of money. So I mean, companies got to realize these are tremendous costs that are that if they don't take good counseling and good advice, that's involved.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of?
And in fact, that what they paid in Siemens is also reflected in the fact that their cooperation reduced what they had to pay
right.
by probably $1 billion or more, as reflected in the DOJ papers.
And one related question would be this. It's often said in the IRS context that if the IRS had more money for enforcement, they could go and pick apples off the trees. And there's widespread tax fraud that exists. Does the same situation exist with the FCPA landscape? If the SEC and DOJ dedicate even more resources, is there ample fraud that could be ferreted out? And
I'm
is this
sure.
still an issue where dramatic underutilization of resources?
Well, you know, if you read some of the publications and Transparency International talks about you know, bribery resulting in over $1 trillion of contracts on an annual basis, one can conclude or at least surmise that there is a fair amount of misconduct out there. I think that the challenge for the regulators will be in, for example, the SEC has said they want to, with this new FCPA unit, become proactive. So how do you become proactive? It's kind of it is difficult for a law enforcement agency by definition to be proactive. You know, a violation or a crime is committed, then a law enforcement agency steps in. How do you prevent the act, or how do you get in ahead of the curve, so to speak? That's going to be a challenge. I mean, some of the things that SEC and DOJ have done have conducted sweeps in certain areas where they were concerned about issues. They may actually look at particular transactions that are publicized to see if there's something going on in a high-risk jurisdiction. But I think that's going to be the area where the agencies are going to have to find a way to kind of get ahead of the curve on this.
Well, and Judge Sporkin, I know from earlier in your career you worked on gatekeepers and enlisting private enforcement. Is that a solution potentially in the FCPA context, giving bounties for people coming forward with violations?
I'm not a bounty guy, but I know they're doing it. Yeah, a whistleblower is, you know, Paul says, you know, what happened? It's a whistleblower will come in, and that's why any company that's engaged in this activity subjects itself to blackmail and extortion.
Sure.
I mean, why, when I was at the CIA, we were always worried about somebody can hold something against somebody that can extract a secret out of them. And so, yeah, a company's got to make sure it's doing the right thing. If it doesn't, it's going to subject itself to tremendous problems. But the companies can do something here, and I'm hopeful that the SEC and the department will realize it. This is the kind of thing I mentioned before, that what ought to happen here is a company agreed to do certain things, agreed to look at its operations, agreed to, once it finds out what it's what they find, you know, over the past several years, to determine if they're going to self-report or not, and then to go to the SEC, if they do, to go to the SEC and see if they can get amnesty for reporting, and agreeing with the SEC that they will take certain steps, such as putting in a FCPA compliance officer, and agreeing to monitor their conduct for the next 5 years or so. There's certain things that I would hope that, look, we found ourselves back when this program started with, we brought 65 prosecutions, and that's in the 70s and early 80s. When we went to our volunteer program, when we asked companies to come in and volunteer, we gave them amnesty, 650 companies came forth. So it seems to me, if it's the SEC's objective to stop this kind of conduct or cut it down as much as possible, then I would hope they will think about a second coming of the volunteer program along the lines that I just mentioned. I've been working on another program, and that is having companies, when they do their financial audit, to include a forensic component in it, because as we're now told, or we now know, that a financial audit doesn't look for fraud, in a sense, and because they're looking for materiality, which is a big number. In these cases, we find it's under the radar screen. It comes out of petty cash and whatnot. And they're not looking at it, and so that's why you need a forensic component in the audit. And I've been working with one accounting firm where we're working on this, and we've had 1 year's. We looked at 1 year's results, and they've been good. And now we're going to look at the second year's results. And if so, we're going to hopefully, bring it to the public and say this makes sense. And so I think there are a number of things that can be done, as Paul says, in a proactive way, and rather than counseling, all these things, rather than using the gatekeepers as a or not call them gatekeepers, but using the lawyers and the accountants as a way to get around the law, to try to face the challenges and deal with the compliance rather than trying to evade it.
When I was at the SEC, and I think that this is still true for the agencies, is when they saw a company that came in with a robust compliance program, one that did the risk assessment, had the policies and procedures in place, had the training, had the testing of their program, I think those are the companies that generally weren't prosecuted, because they did everything that you would expect a company to do, and it had no value from a deterrence or otherwise effect to prosecute those companies. And I think if companies understand that, because the fact of the matter today is if you're operating in a multi-jurisdictional environment, you're in 50 or 60 different countries, something will go wrong. And even with the best compliance program, something will go wrong. So what companies need to have some comfort in is that if they have a strong compliance program, if they've spent some dollars to ensure that they're doing the right things, that even when something goes wrong, they're not going to get prosecuted, or if they get prosecuted, it's not going to be severe. That will go a long way, I think, toward getting companies, if they have that understanding, getting companies to take those actions and be in a good position before a regulator, or should
absolutely,
that arise.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And I would only like to see that gatekeeper approach blossom, as opposed to using the legal talent and whatnot to circumvent the law and or to be giving advice on non-disclosure or don't go to the SEC. And that's why I think if the SEC could do what we did back then and announce the volunteer program, if you come forth, we're going to treat you, we're going to want to treat you differently. I think it would go a long way. I just don't think it's in anybody's interest to just keep getting more and more and more of these cases if they can be avoided and allow the right. And the thing is that the gatekeeper, the lawyer and the accountant wants to do the right thing, needs help.
Right.
Needs the government force behind it, needs something where they can look to, instead of saying, well, we'll take it into them and if they like what you're doing, it's okay. But they need some kind of help and say, hey, look, this is the way we think we ought to go.
Very good. So now, what do you think the significance of the formation of the new FCPA unit at the SEC will be for future enforcement?
Well, it remains to be seen. I think it's a great question. They have a terrific new head of the program with Cheryl Scarborough. I think that she, along with Rob Kazami and his deputy, Lauren Reisner, are going to develop a strong program. They have a lot of people at the agency who know the law, understand the law. They're going to devote a lot of resources. The one thing that they've publicly said is they want to become more proactive, and that's the question that I raised earlier as to how do you do that as a law enforcement agency. I mean, it's not an easy task to take on. I think that they can continue to do sweeps. I think that they can focus on specific transactions that are publicized to gain some insight. But, you know, none of this is a secret. The big issues tend to be, you know, use of agents, distributors, consultants, joint venture relationships. These are the types of things that generally tend to be the areas where you can find issues. So I'm not sure exactly how they're going to become any more proactive than they have been in the past. But that's they've set that task out for themselves, and it'll be interesting to see how it develops.
Well, you had that program by yourself when you were there. You did a pretty good job, Paul. But let me say this to you, and I think Paul would agree with this. The SEC is the finest agency of its kind. There's nobody like it. You can't give me another agency in government that is so devoted to enforcement of the law as they are. Sure, they might misstep here or there. And so you got it. This program in the right hands, and I'm sure they'll see the benefits of how to do the proactiveness at the same time as showing the corporate America how to comply. And when you have a guy like a Berger who ran the program and he's out there now on the other side, he's going to be able to give that kind of advice to clients. And there are others besides Paul, as he knows. But that's really what's going to happen.
Okay. And I agree with the judge. I mean,
I sure you do.
Of course I do. I'd hear from you if I didn't. But no, it is a great agency with great people who are really dedicated to doing their best for investors in the marketplace. And I think that the new program with the FCPA will be I think it will be a success. I think they will do a splendid job, and the marketplace will benefit.
And you got good leadership. That is important. We got good leadership at the division and at the commission, and we'll see what happens. The problem you're going to have now is this pendulum swings, and as the pendulum is swinging pro regulation now because of the almost catastrophic situation we had, it's now starting to come back the other way.
So just get out of the way of that pendulum.
And you're going to see a lot of pressure on the SEC to cut back a little bit. But I'm sorry, you have a question.
Sure. Yeah, sure. One kind of follow-up about this is Roger Blank of Wilkie, Farr & Gallagher had kind of a concrete question about what it means for the SEC to be proactive on FCPA issues. And his question is, has the SEC done a wise or foolish thing in delegating to the enforcement staff the power to issue formal orders and subpoenas?
Well, the staff's always had the power. Once the formal order is issued, they've always had the power and discretion to issue the subpoenas. So that won't really change. What's changed is now the staff has the discretion at a senior level to issue the formal order. I've talked with the judge about this, and frankly, I'm persuaded that I'd rather have the commission issuing the formal order. I don't think it's that big a deal in order to go up and ask for the power. But I think the five commissioners should be taking the responsibility to issue the formal order. I don't think, in the way the commission should run, I don't think it would take a lot of time. It never did when I was there, generally speaking. You go up and you get your formal order. It was almost pro forma. I mean, it's very rare that the commission would be opposed to a formal order. And I like the idea of the commission as a policy matter taking the responsibility for issuing or authorizing the issuance of a formal order.
Okay, well, we're almost out of our time for today, but last question would be this. We've talked a little bit about the importance of international cooperation. Do you think that will be the dominant theme for FCPA enforcement in the years to come?
I think so. I've seen a lot of cooperation among the various countries, and I think this financial debacle that we had, that all these countries that have had lax regulation or not regulation as good as us are looking toward the SEC now to beef up their regulation because they realize what can happen.
I agree. I mean, I think that the future is certainly cooperation, enhanced consultation on sanctions. I think that that's what, when you're representing a company now in an FCPA matter, you're going to be dealing with counsel and the company in various jurisdictions because there may well be investigations and prosecutions in those jurisdictions
I once asked a foreign client of mine while this thing was happening, and he told me that that's a U.S. problem. It's not happening here. Of course, a year later, when their government almost collapsed, or their whole internal system was challenged, I asked him that same question. He realized this is one global marketplace now, and we got to realize it.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Judge Spork and Paul. Really appreciate your insights on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. I know that today's audience, as well as museum visitors who access the program in the future, will benefit from your thoughts on this important subject. Today's Fireside Chat is now permanently preserved in audio format in the virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. A transcript will be added later on. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, let me thank Debevoise and Plimpton, LLP, again for their generous support in making today's broadcast possible. Looking ahead, the Virtual Museum and Archive will next broadcast Self-Regulation in the Securities Industry with James Brigagliano, SEC Division of Trading and Markets, William Brodsky from the Chicago Board Options Exchange, James Duffy from NYSE Regulation Inc., and Richard Cutcham from FINRA on Thursday, June 3rd at 12 noon Eastern Time. Like today's broadcast, the SEC Regulation in the Securities Industry online broadcast will be free and accessible worldwide without prior registration. Unlike today, it will be a live video broadcast and will be moderated by Professor Donna Nagy of Indiana University Maurer School of Law. Please plan to join us on www.sechistorical.org on June 3rd. Thank you for being with us today.